Well, it's good to see everybody this evening. Glad we could be together to study the Word of God. Looks like we have a good number here, and we're thankful for that. God's given us a beautiful day. We continue our study in the life of Christ. If you're visiting with us, we are now in the third quarter of studying through the life of Christ. We're going a little bit deeper than we normally do as we go through the 17 periods of Bible history into the life of Christ, but still maybe not quite as deep as we would like in some areas. The lesson tonight will be covering a lot of very rich and somewhat difficult material, and we might like to have 10 class periods on that, but that's not how this class is set up, and probably just as well at this point. We are, however, going to be able to think together about some things that are happening in the last week of Christ's life leading up to his crucifixion, and this will be found in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21. I'll be using, to begin with, Mark's text, and we'll be looking over at Matthew's text off and on as we go through the lesson, so you might want to open up to Mark 13 and then put a finger or marker over in Matthew 24. Generally, what we'll be looking at is some warnings that Jesus gives to his disciples, and then really to all disciples, for all time. He warns about the destruction of Jerusalem and also about his second coming in this text. Just to overview the message, that's kind of the tell them what you're going to tell them and then tell them and then tell them what you told them. That's how we're going to do it tonight. So what we're going to be talking about in this section, what he talks about, is a message concerning the destruction of Jerusalem and also a message concerning the end of time. Now I will say that there's not universal agreement even on what I just said. There are some who think that most all of this is about the destruction of Jerusalem, all the way not only in Matthew 24, but also in Matthew 25. There are people that think all of that is about the destruction of Jerusalem. There are others who think that both concepts are in this section of Scripture, and they're just sort of mixed in from place to place, and it's hard to figure out from verse to verse which one exactly Jesus is talking about. And then there's the correct interpretation. No, then there's what I believe to be the case is that, especially in Matthew and Mark's account of this, you have the first two-thirds of it talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and I think that'll be pretty clear. And then you have a passage in Matthew chapter 24, verses 34 through 36, Mark chapter 13, verses 30 through 32, those passages give a clear break between the discussion of two different events. One event that was talked about in the earlier part of these chapters would happen before the current generation passed away. Jesus says, this generation will not pass away until all these things are fulfilled. And then he says, but of that day and that hour, no one knows when it will happen. He gives signs about the first thing that's going to happen, but he says nobody knows about the second thing. It's going to come as a thief in the night, and so on and so forth. So he's definitely talking about two different events. And the break in the two events, as I said, is in those verses. And we'll be looking at that as we go through. The destruction of Jerusalem obviously changed Jewish history, but it really changed world history in a lot of ways. It showed that God did indeed, as he had promised he would, punished disobedient Israel. And he'd indicated this in Old Testament prophecies. Jesus is saying it here. Jesus warns about it obliquely in several other passages. Some of the parables that he's taught indicate that God is not happy with the Jews, and that we just looked at a parable class period ago where he said, your house is left to you desolate at the end of talking about those parables. It was going to be that God was going to destroy Jerusalem and pretty much wipe out Israel because of their sinfulness, their rejection of the Messiah. The other thing about this, as far as, you know, getting broad significance out of what Jesus is talking about, is that this is an amazing prophecy. Jesus is going, especially in the destruction of, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, he's going to say a number of things that came true in great detail at the destruction of Jerusalem, just less than 40 years after he said these things. It's really an amazing demonstration of his knowledge as the Son of God. It really proves him to be the Son of God. If any other person had made such a prophecy and told it in such terms as Jesus is going to use here, people would be lauding that person as just an extraordinary, gifted person with foresight, whatever. And here, Jesus did that plainly, and yet a lot of people still want to say, well, you know, he's not anything special. Well, he's plenty special. And even in this prophecy, we see that. So let's start. We'll be looking at Mark chapter 13, I'm sorry, to begin. The text tells us that as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." Jesus answered and said to him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled?" So Jesus is leaving the temple. Again, he's been there all that Tuesday answering the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, difficult questions. We've looked at that over the last couple of class periods. Did a number of things on that, what must have been a very long day. He's coming out, and Jesus tells his disciples that there's not one stone that's going to be left upon another that won't be thrown down. And then when they get to the Mount of Olives, the disciples ask, well, when are these things going to be? In Matthew's account, the question is that they ask is a little bit more detailed, and I think that gives us some important information. So let me just reference that in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 3. When will these things be? That's the first part of the question. And then, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So Matthew clearly breaks it down into two and possibly three questions that the disciples are asking. And Jesus is going to answer both of those questions. When will the temple be destroyed? And when will you come? And what will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age? So he answers both of those. And again, that goes along with what I believe to be the layout of Jesus' speech here, that he's going to talk, first of all, about the destruction of Jerusalem, answering that question, and then he's going to talk about his second coming. This is a view of the Temple Mount as it is today. The Dome of the Rock that you see there with the gold top is almost exactly where the temple would have sat. Of course, that's a Muslim shrine. There's a lot of history to that, but that's almost exactly where the temple would have sat. I'm standing on the Mount of Olives. So Jesus has gone over to the Mount of Olives with his disciples, and some of them ask him this question. They are looking at the temple. They're standing right there where they can see it. I mean, it's right in front of you. And they're discussing what's going to happen to it. I think that's a pretty good staging, to put it mildly. But Jesus is, as we've said, warning that this temple is going to be destroyed. But the temple was still actually in the process of being refurbished, might be a good word for it, but it was major reconstruction. It just wasn't a remodeling. Herod the Great had started this huge rebuilding project for the temple that was actually still going on. You might remember in John chapter 2 and verse 20, and when Jesus was walking in the temple on that occasion, the Jews said, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple." They were still working on it then, 46 years after Herod had started the work, and so there was a lot being done. The temple was built, and then Jesus walked in out of hard white stones, limestone. Each was about 25 cubits in length, eight in height, and 12 in width. These were huge, ginormous stones that had been quarried and somehow, using the ingenuity of the day, stacked on top of one another to build the temple. Just an amazing feat of construction and engineering, even today it would be. So that's what you're thinking about when you're thinking about the temple. And so when when the disciples, when they're coming out of the temple and they're looking at the stones of the temple, and maybe even they're looking at a stone that hadn't been placed yet, you know, who knows, but they're looking certainly at the stones that were placed in the temple, the walls and all that was there, and these huge stones, and they're admiring all of that, as probably anybody would, to see something like that. And Jesus says, well, there's coming a day when one of these stones, not one's going to be standing on top of the other. They're all going to be thrown down. In 1967, and since then, a good bit of archaeological work has been done around the wall of Jerusalem. This is some of the temple stones that were thrown off of the top of the platform and down into the Tyropian Valley that are just still laying there. And these are broken. These are not, you know, the together stones. These are ones that are broken up into bits. So you can imagine how huge the ones were that actually were in the building of the temple. That particular picture was taken by Farrell Jenkins in 2010, and Farrell has spent a lot of time over there digging into a lot of these kinds of things. Well, from that point on, Jesus begins to warn of coming events. Let's look at Mark chapter 13 again. He says in verse 5, in answer to their question, now I think he's answering the first question first. When will these things be? That is, when's the destruction of the temple going to happen? And Jesus starts this way. He says, take heed that no one deceives you, verse 5, for many will come in my name saying, I am he, and will deceive many. So they're going to be false Christs, people who claim to be the Messiah returning or coming. Jesus says, there's going to be a lot of that. That's not necessarily meaning anything's going to happen, but you can expect those things to occur. He says, and when you hear wars and rumors of wars, do not be troubled, for such things must happen, but the end is not yet. So you're going to hear false Christs are going to come along, people claiming to be me. Then you're going to have wars and rumors of wars. That's going to go on. That doesn't necessarily mean that what is going to happen is yet going to happen. He says that nation will rise up against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines and troubles. These are but the beginning of sorrows. So earthquakes, famines, all sorts of different things. But watch out for yourselves, for they will deliver you up to councils. You will be beaten in the synagogues. You will be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony to them. So the saints would be persecuted, particularly the apostles to whom Jesus is speaking directly in these moments. You are going to be persecuted. You are going to be brought up before councils and kings for my sake. And of course, we know that virtually all of the apostles experienced those kinds of persecutions. That was certainly something that came true. They all lived for, you know, either a short time or a long time, but they all experienced those kinds of things, pretty much. But he said also that the gospel must first be preached to all the nations. So before this destruction of the temple, the gospel is going to be preached everywhere. Now, does that necessarily mean that, you know, somebody came over to America and preached to the Indians, Native Americans, whoever you are? I don't know that for sure. I don't know not. I think what it means is that it will be dispersed broadly among humankind. So Paul said in Colossians chapter 1 that that was done. In Colossians 1 verse 5, Paul says, he's writing because of the hope which is laid up for you in heaven, of which you heard before in the word of truth of the gospel, which has come to you as it is also in all the world, bringing forth fruit as it is also among you since the day you heard and knew the grace of God in truth. In verse 23 of Colossians 1, if indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, you might remember that's what Jesus told them to do, preach to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, have become a minister. So Paul asserts twice in Colossians 1 that the gospel had been preached around the world to everybody. Paul is saying that, and he's writing to the Colossians. When did he write to the Colossians? What year is that? About 62, 63 AD. 7 years before 70 AD. What happened in 70 AD? The destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem. So, indeed, the gospel must be first preached everywhere, and one who was preaching it said that it was. He said that it was, although he knew that there were still a couple of places that he had not been that he intended to go, that he wanted to go. He wanted to go beyond Spain, for instance. We have no record of him doing that, as of yet at least, when he writes to the Colossians. So, yet he avers that the gospel had indeed been preached, in some sense at least, to the whole world. In the next couple of verses, back in Mark chapter 13, when they arrest you, Jesus says, and deliver you up, do not worry beforehand nor premeditate what you will speak, but whatever is given you in that hour, speak that, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. What does that tell us, again, about who Jesus is talking about? Who's he saying that these things will happen to? Well, the apostles, right, are Spirit-guided individuals, people who would speak by revelation and inspiration, the apostles and prophets of Jesus Christ, and particularly these four apostles who'd ask him these questions. He goes on to say in verse 12 that brother will betray brother to death, father his child, children will rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. Those kinds of things happened certainly before the destruction of Jerusalem. And he says in verse 13 that you will be hated by all men for my name's sake, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. We'll go on and look at verse 14. And then he gets to some specificity as to when to expect this destruction to happen. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet standing where it ought not, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down into the house, nor enter in to take anything out of his house. But let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. Pray that your flight not be in the winter. For in those days there will be tribulation such as not been since the beginning of creation, which God created until this time, nor shall ever be. And unless the Lord shorten those days, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, whom he chose, he shortened the days. All right. So it's going to happen. It's going to happen specifically when what happens, when you see what happening. The abomination of desolations, standing in a place where it ought not. Well, that seems a little bit cryptic, doesn't it? What in the world could that mean? Well, thankfully, we have other scriptures that can enlighten us. Daniel chapter 9 really helps us here. Daniel 9 is a messianic prophecy concerning the coming of the Messiah's kingdom that Daniel saw. Almost 600 years before the coming of Christ. I'm just going to read part of this, but it's Daniel 9 and verse 26. He's talking about a period of weeks leading up to the coming of the Messiah and then the Messiah being cut off. So here we go. We're in the middle, a little bit of a context. But Daniel 9, verse 26. After the 62 weeks, the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. So the prince who's to come is going to destroy the city, Jerusalem, and the sanctuary. That would be the temple. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. Desolations are determined until the end of the war. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be the one who makes desolate. Somebody's coming to make desolate on the wing of abominations, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. An abomination of desolation. When did the sacrifices stop? When was the temple destroyed? And who did it? Well, the Romans did it, right? Under Titus. And it happened in 70 AD. The temple was destroyed. There was time when it actually did happen for the Jews to see it was going to happen, because the Roman army was stalled out for some time before it got to Jerusalem. You could see it coming. You could see it standing in a place where it wasn't supposed to be. And they knew at that time it was time to hightail it. So all of that, those are facts of history. You can look all that up. But that's what happened. There's a person who saw it happen by the name of Josephus. And he wrote a history about that. And we'll talk a little bit about that some more in a minute. So Jesus says in the reading that I gave you that they were to flee for a place of safety. They should do so immediately. It's going to be difficult for mothers with infants, and they should pray for God's providential help as they tried to escape the coming army. What would happen inside Jerusalem as the Romans were destroying it is some of the most horrific things that have ever happened to anybody anywhere. There was starvation. There was eating of children. There was the priests trying to keep the gold of the temple from being taken by the Romans, and so they ate it. And when the Romans discovered that they had done that, when they broke through, they disemboweled the priests to get the gold out of their stomachs. It's just one horrible, horrendous, awful thing right after another in the destruction that ensued. And so what Jesus says is that the tribulation would be the worst that had ever been seen and or would ever be seen, and only God's mercy would enable anybody to survive. As I said, Josephus was a Jew. He had been captured by the Romans shortly before this and was traveling with them when they took the city. He claims to have been there and seen it, and there's not any reason to doubt that. I'd like to read a little bit of his account of it. Josephus wrote that no other city ever suffered miseries, nor did any age from the beginning of the world ever breed a generation more fruitful in wickedness than this was. He said, if the miseries of all mankind from the creation were compared with those which the Jews then suffered, they would appear inferior. There is at least one person's judgment that it was the worst thing that ever happened to anybody anywhere, and that was somebody that saw it. Somebody that had seen a lot of things and would see a lot more when he wrote those histories. So I think that's interesting testimony that we have from outside the Bible about what happened. Of course, a lot of history records the events of the destruction of Jerusalem. Disciples should be aware that false Christs again would come during this time. And disciples should be prepared, because Jesus told them beforehand what to expect. In verse 23, when Jesus is saying this, he's making sure his disciples are understanding, I'm telling you ahead of time what's going to happen, so you can be prepared when it does, so you can flee when it does, so you can have the advantage of escaping all of this when it does happen. All right, let me stop right here and ask if anybody has a question about anything we've covered so far. Anybody has a comment about anything we've covered so far? Yeah, I don't think he means all flesh all over the world. I think he means, right. Right. Or at least in the area, because I think the Romans would have just continued to obliterate. And the fact that they you know, followed the crew to Masada and made sure that they were exterminated as well is indicative of how far they were willing to go to take all of Israel out. Good question. In verse 24, in those days, after that tribulation, the sun shall be darkened and the moon will not give its light. Jesus is continuing to talk about the destruction of Jerusalem, but again, using language that's what we call apocalyptic, it's highly symbolic. It's language that the Old Testament prophets use many times to talk about these sorts of things, with nations falling or cities falling, God changing up whole civilizations at times, and this sort of language is used to prophesy about that repeatedly. 24 and 25, in those days after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, then the moon will not give its light, the stars of the heaven will fall, the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Sounds like, if you read that literally, of course, that, wow, you're looking up at the sun, moon, and stars, and you're going to be able to see things going on up there, cosmic disturbances, and so on and so forth. But again, that's language that is symbolic. And one of the ways I like to explain this is, if you're thinking about a symbol for governing powers, for big nations and empires, sun, moon, and stars work pretty well as a symbol. Let's go back to the creation of the sun, moon, and stars. God created the greater light to, finish the sentence, rule the day, and the lesser lights to rule the night. Okay, so they're ruling celestial things, right? And from that, then, as I said, the Old Testament prophets take those concepts and use them to refer to nations. Stars oftentimes refer to political leaders or kings. So you have sun, moon, stars, all of that changing up. We have an idea about the sun, for instance, that it's a permanent fixture, that it's always going to be exactly like it is and always has been, that it's something we can absolutely count on. So we'll say things like, as sure as the sun comes up in the morning, as sure as the sun comes up in the morning. Sun comes up every morning, right? What if it doesn't? If it doesn't, then things have really changed, right? They've really changed. So, yeah. What about America? You know, America is always going to be here, right? No. Rome was always going to be, no. Well, Judah and Jerusalem, God's people, surely that's always going to be there. No. So, sure as the sun comes up in the morning, uh-uh. God's changing all of that up, and that's where the symbolism comes from. But initially, if you go back and look, there are passages like in Isaiah chapter 13. It's a prophecy against Babylon. It's talking about the destruction of Babylon about 150 years before Babylon was destroyed. You can read that in chapter 13 and verse 1, the burden against Babylon. Chapter 13 and verse 9 of Isaiah, behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with wrath, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate. He will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. Same exact kind of wording describing the destruction of Babylon. You have other indications, that language being used for other situations where God took down nations as well. We might look at some of that in a minute. But the cosmic chaos symbolizes political and social upheaval. Luke's account of this, and I haven't referenced Luke much in this, he doesn't give us as much information, but Luke's account of this kind of makes that clear. Luke chapter 21, Jesus again saying, talking about the same stuff, and this is just Luke's account of it. Jesus says, Luke 21 verse 25, there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth, distress of nations. So the signs in the sun, moon, and stars are relating to distress of nations, with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing from fear, and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Things coming on earth as the powers of the heavens are shaken. That's the connection that is made in Luke's gospel. So hopefully we can relate to that. Well, these events are going to cause men to clearly see the power of Christ. In Mark chapter 13 and verse 26, then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Some would say, well, that's a description of the second coming of Christ. Maybe, but I don't think so. I think in this context, it's Him coming in judgment. The Lord coming in clouds, the Lord coming in judgment, the day of the Lord, used repeatedly in the Old Testament, those kinds of phrases to describe God coming on a nation or a city, not the end of time. Okay? So it is a coming in judgment, but it's not the final coming in judgment that Jesus is here talking about. The true elect are going to be gathered together, probably symbolizing their protection and safety in contrast to Israel, who will be judged and destroyed. You have that in Mark 13, 27. He will send His angels, gather His elect out of the four winds, from the farthest part of the earth and from the farthest part of heaven. Then you have, here's an artist's painting of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. That's just an artist's rendition of it, but as I said, it was a horrific event. And you have Jesus, again, using the fig tree as a lesson, something we need to learn from the fig tree. This is the parable from the fig tree in verse 28. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that the summer is near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that it is near at the door. So you can see this happening. You can see when it's going to happen. You can see it coming because of the things I've told you here. That's what He's saying to them. Just like you know when the fig tree's fixing to bloom. You know when the leaves are fixing to come out. You just watch it. You can see it happening. And so He's saying you can see this happening. It would be near and at the door. And then He says the thing in verse 30. Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. So everything we've covered up to here, Jesus is saying, it's going to happen before this generation passes away. Less than 40 years later, it happened. And a generation's about 40 years. So the destruction of Jerusalem, occurring in 70 AD, happened on this time frame. Heaven and earth might pass away, but Jesus' words are going to stand. And that's a pretty important lesson to take out of this as well. Now Jesus picks up warning of His return. Let me catch up in my notes a little bit. He says, and I'm going to go in 13, verse 32, of that day and hour, after He's just talked about something you can see coming, you'll know when it's going to happen, but He says, but of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Here's something that nobody knows when it's going to happen. Remember the two questions that they ask. When will this be? When will the destruction of Jerusalem be? And then when is your coming and the end of the age or the end of the world, depending on your translation? So now Jesus is talking about that second question they asked. Nobody knows when that's going to happen. Nobody knows when that's going to happen. Let's go over to Matthew's gospel and notice in Matthew 24 now. Matthew is very close to Mark and what they're saying and how they're rendering all of this. But Matthew does have a little bit more information in this section. So verse 36 is the same as what we just read in Mark, Matthew 24, verse 36. Of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as were the days of Noah, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in the days of Noah, as in the days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, and given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark. They did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. It's like people weren't ready. They didn't know it was coming. It came on them. They were just going about their business, and all of a sudden, it was there. They weren't expecting it. Then, he says, two men will be in the field, one will be taken and another left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken, the other left. Watch, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. So he says it again and again in this context. the disciples must watch. It will be like the days of Noah. People have not been prepared. It will be two individuals be side by side. One is taken and the other, and another is left. What is that describing? Well, we know what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4, that we that are alive till the coming of the Lord are not going to precede those that have already died. For those who have died in Christ will rise first, right? And then we who are alive will be caught up to join them, and so we will ever be with the Lord if we're in the Lord. What about the person who's standing next to me that's not a Christian when that happens? One's taken and another's left. Okay? So that corresponds very well with Paul's description of what happens when Jesus comes. Right. Right. Wayne's saying, in the first part, he said, you remember the destruction of Jerusalem, when you see it coming, run, get out of town. Now, there's no running. You know, you're going to be out there in the field together, all of a sudden somebody's gone, somebody's not. And the one who's not gone, by the way, who stays on earth, what they get to do is they get to enjoy being on earth as it's completely destroyed in the conflagration of fire and experience a horrible end to all of that is. The elements will melt with fervent heat, Peter says. So the evil people get to stay on earth and enjoy that. I'm using that sarcastically, obviously, but those who are saved are with the Lord, protected from it. Yeah, there's not going to, the die is cast. There's not going to be any time, you know, there's going to be a short amount of time, but not a lot to do much, right? that's meaningful. So it's going to come as a thief in the night, Jesus says in Matthew 24, 33 and 34, or 43 and 44. He says it's like a man going away to a far country. He commands his servants to watch for his return, but he doesn't tell them when he's coming back. So they have to be ready anytime. That's exactly what Jesus has done. He's gone away. He hasn't told us when he's coming back. We don't know. There's no indicator. Despite what all the false prophets and false teachers are saying today about this being for sure the end times, nobody knows that. Nobody knows. There's no way of knowing that. So Jesus says you're not going to know. You just need to be ready every moment. We must not be found sleeping when the Master returns. He says repeatedly, we must watch. Watch, be ready, be sober. All right. Which leads you right into chapter 25, which Brother Wayne will cover Sunday morning in fine fashion, I'm confident, as chapter 25 presents the parable of the 10 virgins. You know, 5 were ready, 5 were not. The parable of the talents, the judgment scene, all of this still continuing to help his disciples and others know to be prepared when he comes again. Anything else? Thoughts or questions, comments? All right. Thank you for your good attention tonight. Hope that's helpful. I might just say in closing maybe that this is a difficult text. I don't have all the answers to every question that might be asked about it for sure. Obviously have a conviction about what it teaches, but I'm not sure I could answer every question about everything somebody might ask. So I'll just say that if somebody does have every answer to every question somebody might ask, they probably need to reevaluate that. Okay.